Hello, and welcome to Ladies with Gumption, Episode 80, Impulse Control. We are the Ladies of Gumption. We recap DCTV in a flash. I'm Tatiana, and I'm here with...
Jessica.
And May.
You can find us on Twitter at DCTVGumption, on Tumblr at LadiesWGumption at Tumblr.com, or you can email us at LadiesWGumption at gmail.com. You can also find our podcast wherever you find podcasts, such as iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and Facebook. Don't forget that you can give us money at our Patreon, patreon.com/DCTVGumption. And we have a new shirt design. Thank you, May. If you like us and you know it, send us cash. We have a little bit of news. First, it's a little bit awkward, we've learned that Swamp Thing, the episode order was cut down to 10 episodes. It was originally going to be 13, I think, or maybe even 16. But now it's going to be 10. And supposedly the reason was creative differences, which to me sounds bad enough. Like, sounds like season 2 of American Gods tease. But now people are saying, like, the rumor is that it's really financial difficulties, right? That DC Universe is in a strap. They're not really making that much money, which makes sense because they don't have that much content. And so, like, they're still raising prices, but now they have, like, even fewer episodes to give you. So, yeah.
Or they spend awkward. All their money on Doom Patrol.
Maybe. Maybe they spend all their money on The Favorite Child, and they're like, oh, wait, we have no more left for Swamp Thing.
Or, like, because Stargirl hasn't started yet, right?
Right.
So maybe they wanted to move some cash over to Stargirl, so it's like, you know what, by the way, Swamp Thing, we're cutting
that's very possible. Down. That's very possible. We also know that the Krypton Season 2 premiere date is June 12th, so goodbye summer hiatus. They did release a trailer. I have not watched that trailer, but I am sure it was excellent.
I will say, though, because you guys have, like, early release of, like, the Krypton, a couple episodes have been released for you guys.
At least 5 of them, which is unusual.
Well, if you watch those and you tell me if it's worth watching season 2.
That's fair.
If it's not, then we will not cover it.
There you go.
That's
I like
fair.
That.
Okay.
So stay
tuned. We'll not put ourselves through that. We'll just put May
yeah.
through that.
May will be our guinea pig.
I will all take right. it one for the team.
Now we will have some abbreviated feedback. Shy One sent us a lovely long email explaining her thoughts on harassment and bullying versus not taking a stand with harassment and bullying. And we won't read the whole thing, but if anyone would like to chime in on that, especially, like, regarding the Supergirl cast standing together in the face yeah. of Ozzy's bullying versus,
yeah.
you know, can the
Crickets.
Flash cast.
Crickets
yeah, Crickets. Flash Crickets cast. For Candace. Exactly.
Well, I think, like, the main thing is, like, you know, she was bringing up the point that some people handle confrontation in different ways, and you can't really fault someone for, you know, like, not being... like Macaw, if that's not the way that they deal with confrontation or they don't feel comfortable that way just because of different experiences in their life. And I get that. And I think mm-hmm. In fandom, it's like that too, where you have certain people that are go hard, Twitter keyboard warriors, they're always on it. And then there are some people that just, that's not their lane. Like me personally, mm-hmm. I don't have that kind of energy. Like for the people that do have that kind of energy, I'm glad that they're able to do that, like in the beginning of seasons, like Tatiana, you was definitely one of those people that if you were speaking any kind of trash, any kind
I
of
find you.
She would find you and she would literally like destroy you with words. I'm not like that, so my way of like supporting Candace was different, and you know that's even if you look at the Supergirl cast, the way that they all supported her,
mm-hmm.
you had keyboard warrior like Macaw, you had the subtweets from Nicole and Andrea. They didn't address mm-hmm. it directly, but they tweeted about it. And
right.
you didn't even know that that's what they were tweeting about until, like, Macaw came out.
Yeah,
and then you
yeah.
have Melissa that didn't even really say anything. All she did was post a picture and put an emoji mm-hmm. card. But
yeah, and even Katie, who doesn't have Twitter, is always like, shows up.
Yeah, and she
supportive.
Was at that lunch mm-hmm. to
yeah.
be there for AZ. So, mm-hmm. like, even though they didn't all show their support in the same way, it was very clear that, you know, they did something. Like, each thing was different, but it was something. That kind of support is different from no support, like not seeing, like not being there. And the person that is the victim of all of the racist, like, and bullying, so for example, Candace or AZ, like, they can tell you whether they're being supported or not. Just like in the beginning of the seasons when, you know, Grant has always been kind of hit or miss with how to be publicly supportive. But in the beginning of the seasons, Candace would bring him up without even anybody asking about it.
Right.
So you could tell, like, she was getting support from him because she said that. And the way that she talked about him. The way, so, like, there, and if someone wasn't doing that for her, then she wouldn't be talking about them, or she wouldn't have that kind. You can tell, you know, even from all my eyeballs on social media, all the way back in Tennessee, I could tell if someone was showing support or not. So,
yeah. And then, like, for example, the second that Hartley Sawyer showed up, he was already, like, in Candace's comment section, being like, actually, she's talking about white privilege, which I have.
Yeah, so even, like, you know, and, like, in this season, and I guess starting, like, last season, when she got started to get closer to Tom, like, Tom Campbell doesn't use his social media all that much, but, like, some of the things that he did for her, like, with the Backstreet Boys and, you know, taking pictures and videos, you don't have to come out and say, like, racial bullying is wrong, stop it, you guys. But you can do things like take pictures and just show, like, you don't have to come out and say you're against racial bullying, but there are things you can do, like supporting your castmate with pictures or you know, anything else that makes it clear that you like this person and that you don't want people to be mean to them because that's your friend. And if you are a fan of me, then you will be nice to my friend.
Yeah, like the one time that Grant did that, when he retweeted Orlando Jones with the, you know, West Allen forever, and like, if you say Snowberry again one more time, I dare you, kind of thing, the Protect Iris West tweet, he didn't get a single tweet of pushback, because it was him doing it.
Yeah.
So, but alas, then he was like, never again.
And he just quit Twitter altogether.
Yep. Moving on. Thank you for your feedback, Shaiwan. We always appreciate getting emails from you. We've also got our correspondents for all our shows. So let's start with Tasha for Arrow. Tasha liked this episode with very little Oliver, which is a good sign for the future, Tasha. So that's good. Loved the Quiggle bromance, but they were the most boring part of the episode. Nobody cares for the Longbow Hunters unless it's Silencer. And she called Dante being the one who killed Emiko's mother in January. Well, Tasha knows everything about this show, so that is great. Loved Oliver calling his baby precious cargo, giving foot rubs at the end of the day. Yes, he was very soft with his wife, and I loved that too, Tasha. The good stuff was Birds of Justice. Enjoyed watching all four women come together because of their varied abilities and their drastically different origin stories. Sarah Lance is back. Love that for me. She's always been Tasha's favorite canary, had some great lines. If Felicity had ever happened, she would have been first in line for smoking canary. Aw, they did have a cute little moment there. Loved Felicity as the optimist, stubbornly holding on to belief in Laurel, and one of the most surprising bonds of the season has been Siren and Felicity. I agree with this. Dinah was the right person to have the opposing perspective because she has a valid reason to hate Siren. True. That being said, her hands are not clean. And one thing that they've done all season is show that Siren has been straddling the line. She hasn't been totally good or redeemed. When she heard Diaz was back in town, she wanted to kill him. When the judge ruled against her, she tried to kill her. So it's easy for her to backslide. So yeah, so her reaction made sense. All right. Mia is too painfully stubborn. She is season one Oliver, and all these heroes are going to have to keep beating her over the head with the lesson that she needs to let people help her. Yep, I agree with this. She's got some predictions. We'll talk about that when we talk about Arrow. And she's mad that Mikan had to stand up against the fans. I totally agree with you with that. It's unfortunate that he had to do it, but I'm glad that he did it. And also, the Goodbye OTA project raised over $26,000. That's amazing.
Woo!
They struck a deal for the billboard, so the $20,000 is being split between different charities that focus on building schools, children's cancer research, and someone on the Arrow crew whose family is battling cancer. Aw, that's really nice. I'm really glad to hear that. Now we've got Shang, who I guess there was no Supergirl, so he's taken over Legends for us. He's going to put this out there, a 24-hour podcast.
No, sir.
You know, it's actually kind of funny because I was going to say the Flash podcast, or really the DCB podcast network, they do the podcast share of charity, right? So they will do like a 24-hour podcast for charity, which like I guess you pledge money to like listen to people talk for 24 hours or however long, 18 hours.
You want to pledge money
for charity, not for us.
For charity.
Okay. Legend feedback. This episode was just horny. he felt the magical fugitive incorporated quite nicely into the historical setting and was such a charmer. They made good use of him, which is something the writers have not done in a while. He's got to say that Zari and the fugitive had better chemistry than her with Nate. Sorry,
yes. Back.
Tisk. Flash feedback. Nora's story paralleled with Barry's and was pretty amazing. I enjoyed this episode. It felt like an excess pilot episode. Mm-hmm. Only thing I didn't like is that Leah died. Yeah. Bad time. The villain was kind of underwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
For a name that's Godspeed, they could have used, like, Inertia or Cobalt Blue. Cobalt Blue, of course! They should have used Cobalt Blue! Okay, moving on. Barry's message to Nora got me in tears. Those red skies behind him, though, it really is crisis. I think because Nora's been changing the timeline, Barry's chance of not disappearing is increasing. That's true. I think I'm with the theory of Nora's current timeline being erased and Iris having twins. Yes! I am 100% correct. Thank you. Okay. We've got Mara. She watched Godspeed with zero expectations, but ended up enjoying it in spite of herself. It wasn't an amazing show-stopping episode of The Flash. It came too late in the game. The show dragged out the Thawne reveal too long, and Godspeed was a watered-down, lackluster villain. However, there are things that it did well. I realized my problem with The Flash over the last 4 to 5 odd episodes, or the entirety of 5B, with the notable exceptions, is that the show has been a slog. Norrigan's origin story was a different structure for the show. It gave Nora more dimensions to her character and removed the drudgery of Star Labs. Agreed. 2049 is slick, atmospheric, and lighter than expected. Jessica Parker Kennedy got some of the meatiest material, and she chewed up every scene she was in. The transition of Nora getting her powers and then discovering the chip and going to Thawne, plus witnessing her friend's death, propelled her to learn how to defeat Godspeed, which was really good storytelling. I sympathize with Nora and her decisions, given her circumstances. I agree with this. The scene between Nora and future Iris tore my heart to shreds, especially when Nora told Iris that she had lost her. As you could see, all of Iris' devastation. Iris is still, of course, as hot as ever, even in 2049. On the downside, Barry was unnecessarily cruel. I know he's acting completely out of anger and that Thawne is his berserk button, but asking for the room with Nora felt deceptive. He knew he was going to run her to the future, but he deliberately misled Iris and did not want her or the rest of the team to stop him. Yes!
Yep.
He drove her to the future and dumped her there with a half-hearted goodbye and then raced to confront Ambard, not knowing that he's just playing into Ambard's hand. Yes! Thank you! Okay, it's also really unfair to Iris. I totally agree with all of this. However, she thinks Grant did some fantastic work in the scenes, and this video message from Barry also broke her heart. All right. Thank you, Mara. Danielle, this week's Arrow was Laurel-centric, so I definitely need to comment on that. All right. After the latest episode, I was pissed. Amico leaking the images definitely felt like they were essentially dismantling the legacy Earth-1 Laurel left, which was my fear when Siren first started posing as Earth-1 Laurel. On top of that, Dinah's sudden mistrust felt out of nowhere, so I thought this would be Katie's last episode, and I went in expecting the worst. I think a lot of us were feeling that way.
Yeah.
I definitely had issues, and I don't really like the build of Laurel's aggression. And then as for Sarah, I was surprised with how she was used. I'm a little jaded with how the show and fans have pitted Sarah and Laurel in the past, so I was worried they wouldn't let Laurel be as powerful as they've shown her to be. But when Sarah was first introduced on Arrow, they downgraded her power, strength, and skill, and relegated her to being three other villains' henchwoman. So she actually liked how Sarah acknowledged screwing over Laurel. She expressed guilt, and I'm sure she's had a great hero's journey, but she was never like, sleeping with Oliver while you were in love with him was really messed up, and I'm sorry. That has always bothered me. So yes, I agree. It was nice to see Sarah own up to her actions and actually relate to Laurel on a personal level. Cool. Also, the Canary Network was built on E1 Laurel's legacy, which is super sweet. On to The Flash. I like the future stuff. Nora felt like an actual adult for once, which was weird but nice. Her and Leah had a really sweet dynamic. Leah dying was bullshit. Agreed. Still unsure about Nora and future Iris' dynamic. I couldn't tell if their friction before Nora found out was just her being bratty, or if there was just, or if there were actually issues before. And I'm not sure what I would prefer. At this point, Iris's reason for the chip is that she was protecting her. Do you think Iris putting blame on herself to hide the larger reason why a chip would protect her, or am I just digging because I was hoping for more meat? It's a good question.
Well, I think we kind of indirectly got at that when they found out about, like, Cicada in the future not stopping, like, right. Still being around, still killing metas.
Yeah, we thought that that's what it was going to be.
Yeah, and I think that could be, because at that point, because this is like a flash-forward flashback, so at that point, future Iris didn't really get a chance to say fully what why her reasons were.
It's possible that we'll get a little bit more explanation later on down the line. Yeah. Barry kind of sucks. This is so disappointing. Yes, I totally agree. I understand that Thawne is a different wheelhouse entirely, so when it comes to him, he acts in extremes. But his reaction to Nora was malicious. And he, more than anyone, knows what it's like to be manipulated. Yes. Barry's so ill-defined right now, it's disappointing. Hopefully next season they work at reestablishing his characters, because at this point, everyone just does what the plot needs. Yep. You're right. All right. Paulina said, hope you're all doing well. Thank you, we are. Having a great week. Are you all having a great week?
I suppose I am.
I've had a very busy week, so.
Yes. Yeah. Back with feedback because of Flash being back, there was no more ingenious way to breathe life into the season than 518. In fact, I'm sending my feedback earlier than usual because I want to send it right after I finish the episode, so my excitement about this episode resonates in my words. The not-so-great stuff was that the initial argument between Barry and Iris should not have taken place in front of the rest of the team. It's a personal predicament for them as parents and as a couple. But it was pretty muted and pretty short. And it led into Iris getting angry with Sherlock. So, yes, that's true. Her anger was not misplaced. She told him to back off many times. Not only did he invade her daughter's privacy, he also breached Iris' trust by not telling her why he had been investigating Nora. And she'd questioned him about it at least twice. The real disappointment in the episode was Godspeed himself. I never thought that the Flash's iteration of August Hart would live up to expectations, but his appearance was and backstory were haphazard and lazy. Yes, I agree with this. But now the good stuff, which was the vast majority of the episode. There's so much for me to gush over enthusiastically, but I'm going to split it into Nora, Iris, and Barry, so I can prevent it from being a vaguely jointed piece of my extremely jumbled thoughts, which is how all of my thoughts are, but okay. I said that. I'm the one who's extremely jumbled, not Paulina. She's obviously very organized. Nora. This was Nora's much-needed origin story episode. It didn't move the plot forward. But we needed a proper narrative of how and why Nora came to work with Thawne, and this episode seamlessly portrayed that and made it inevitable. I agree. I like Leah. Her death is a turning point for Nora, and it spurred her to really want to train with Thawne. I thought this was vaguely a best friend to lovers, but not realizing poor Nora's case because Leah died. The glimpse into Nora and Iris' relationship pre-chip reveal demonstrated that without the influence of the clouded judgment of Iris, they were actually endearing. The conversation on the phone was cute. Nora was happy about Iris calling her, but still wanted to talk to her mom and was apologetic about inadvertently bringing up Barry's death, while Iris was very protective and sweet as always. Their casual I love you exchange over the phone warmed my heart and demonstrated that they did have a healthy relationship, given the circumstances. I also think the chip reveal was well handled. Mm-hmm. Coupled Leah's death, it was the precipice which tipped Nora over, and I think Nora's emotional reaction was completely understandable, even though it hurt my heart when she told Iris how she had lost her. Equally, the narrative did not vilify Iris. I felt so much for this woman who had lost everything and was desperately trying to keep her child safe. Mm-hmm. The scene between future Iris, who is as gorgeous as ever, and Nora was heart-wrenching and delivered beautifully by both Candace and Jessica. Nora's relationship with Thawne was quite fascinating to watch play out. Seeing him gain her trust and train her paralleled his training of Barry in season one. Yes. And there are many more lovely parallels. Plus, the message from Barry at the crisis was great work by Grant and a lovely parallel to Iris leaving Barry her vows via video message in 322. I agree with this. Meanwhile, Iris. I wish we had seen a little bit more of future Iris, but I love what we did see of her. She's loving and kind mother, but she's made mistakes, and her overprotectiveness was completely understandable and doesn't negate her unconditional love for Nora. It was indicative of how much she's lost and how worried she is about losing the one thing most precious to her. In the present, Iris is still dealing with guilt and she's always blaming herself, often unfairly burdening herself with such guilt. But this time, it's a lot more cathartic because now she and Nora have a good relationship. It's natural for Iris to feel like Nora deserves a second chance, because she's obviously forgiving and magnanimous, but also inherently maternal. Mm-hmm. I'm also ready for Candace to destroy me with her performance next episode. Mm-hmm. Yes. Barry. Already spoke about the video, but let's talk about Barry in the present. I'm conflicted because I felt so much for him, and I thought he was completely valid when he told Nora that he understands why she went to Thawne, but he doesn't understand why she kept going back after she'd known his past and the fact that Thawne killed his mother. He was right about that, but after listening to Nora's journey, he must have known it was incredibly difficult for her to just disentangle herself from his machinations when she had learned everything from him. I felt so bad for Nora when she was pleading with Barry, and his decision to leave her in the future was stone cold. The last part especially gets to me, because he asks for the room with Nora, and Iris unhesitatingly says, of course, since it's unimaginable to her, that Barry would do something so drastic and honestly a bit cruel. Mm-hmm. The final scene between Thawne and Barry was incredible, though, and Grant delivered such a good performance in the final 3 minutes of the episode between Barry's final scene with Nora and the after credits with Thawne. So, yes, all in all, many positive feelings. Looking forward to West Allen Angst destroying us for the better next week. And Candace is already making her tear up in the promo. Accurate! Finally, Swara! Alright, Swara, what did you have to say to us? Hey, ladies. So I don't know how to feel about this week's legends. Me either, Swara! It seems the writers and showrunners have completely forgotten Zari's backstory and her goals of changing the future. Apparently, because they have a woman and a man single on the ship, Parrish thought of that for a same-sex couple, they have to put all their creative power into a romance storyline that has no build-up whatsoever because they have little to no imagination of how to build off of what they previously established. Also, I couldn't care less about Mona at this point. The writers have not made her into a compelling character, but rather an annoying tag-along on the ship. I liked the musical number and the focus on female friendships, and overall I thought the episode was funny. But I do not appreciate how they're handling my favorite character, Zari. I can't wait to hear what you think. And you will hear what we think, my friend. You will. Okay. So with that out of the way, I believe that the lovely May can lead us into our side A. And of course, the format will be Arrow and Legends on side A, and then Flash on Doom Patrol on side B. We will talk about our likes, our dislikes, and then crown a Lady with Gumption of the Week.
Yes, I will lead you into the trenches of the Arrowverse / DC Universe. So, side A, Lifeline / Happily Ever After, we will begin with Arrow. Katie Lotz guest stars for a Birds of Prey episode. After being accused of murder and having her criminal past exposed, Laurel goes full Black Siren and teams up with an old criminal acquaintance, Shadow Thief, to go on a crime spree around Star City. While Dinah aims to bring Laurel in, Felicity refuses to give up on her friend and tries everything to get through to her, even summoning Sarah Lance for help. However, Laurel rebuffs all her efforts, forcing the former friends to face off against each other. Kristen Wendell directed the episode written by Jill Blankenship and Eliza Delphin. So what did we like about this episode? It's all mostly female-centered episode.
Well, that's the big thing to like, that it was all mostly female-centered episode, because it's one thing that, you know, the women of the Arrowverse have been talking about for a long time and wanting to do something like this. So I like that they had, like, an all-canary episode and made kind of all Birds of Prey, and all the ladies were really involved, and how that paralleled in the future to there being that canary support system still being around in the future. I really like that as well. And, like, the crux of the episode really relied on the bond that the women had with each other, and specifically the bond between Laurel and Felicity and the faith that Felicity had in Laurel that made her not want to give up on her friend. Like, that relationship that was kind of, I guess it would be, like, the, kind of what Tasha said, the most, like, unexpected relationship is also kind of become, like, the one of my favorites, and kind of, like, the heart of that group. Just the bond that they formed and continued to grow over the latter half of the season. Or I guess from the beginning when they bonded over wanting to kill Diaz. So, really developed into something that was tangible. So I'm glad at the first sign of trouble, Felicity didn't just automatically flip like Laurel's girlfriend did, and that she fought for her when others like Laurel's girlfriend, aka Dinah, wouldn't. So as you can tell, I'm a little bit upset about my crack ship. So although Sarah's like introduction into the episode I felt was a little boxy, like she just kind of showed up out of nowhere, and there wasn't really kind of any lead in to Felicity wanting to bring her in or talking to, like, a scene to show how Sarah got there or when she called her or from where Sarah came from. But I did like that Sarah's one-on-one with Laurel at the graveyard. Because, again, I think it was Danielle was saying that, you know, she was unsure of how this episode was going to work when we first heard about it. And I was also unsure, like, you know, with Sarah coming in and being on, like, the good side, quote-unquote, going after Laurel, like, oh, no, here we go again. Back on our bullshit. But I did, it was really, like, refreshingly surprising that Sarah's, like, one-on-one with Laurel at the graveyard and how she approached Laurel, one misfit to another, really had them, like, kind of on the same page. And it was kind of the first, like, Sarah's talking to she's been wanting to bring back her sister for years, and so getting the chance to speak to someone with her sister's face and them both bonding over Quentin and Sarah talking, like, from her guilt, and, like, she's not putting Laurel down for the choices that Laurel's had to make in her life. I liked their relationship as well. And I also like the little hint that I think we got, like, a little nugget drop that Sarah on E2 was pregnant at some point and had kids, because when Laurel took, like, the champagne from Felicity, she's like, I had to do this for my sister, so I know. I was like, oh, my God. So, anyway. And that, too, that little moment where Laurel is supporting Felicity by not revealing that she can't have champagne because she's pregnant, I thought was really a really little cute touch as well. So all of that was good. I like that this episode was mostly a women's team-up episode and that the theme, like I said, is consistent both the present and the future. Even Laurel's bad girl partner was also a girl. So it's like Shadow Thief was also, it's like bad women team-up versus good women team-up. And it worked. There was a lot of action. It wasn't just, you know, it was a good, solid episode of Arrow on its own. And I liked that Diggle and Oliver had the minor B-plot and they didn't really get in the way. And because I imagine if Oliver knew that Felicity was running around dodging bombs, he would have something to say about it. So I'm glad they were kind of, like, removed, and it was just, they were not even a part of that at all. I like the concept of the Canaries Network in the future, because I think it's something that Dinah Laurel Lance from the comics would have been a fan of and really would have liked. And then I also like the meeting between Nia and Laurel, because I feel like it will make a significant impact, hopefully, on Nia going forward in the future. On the bros side, I like that Oliver took the approach of finding his sister's mother's killer, because it means that at the heart of it, Oliver still has faith in Emiko as well. So you have that kind of parallel with Oliver and his sister and Felicity and Laurel having faith that they can change, that they're not evil, that they're not too far gone. Mambo Hunters are relevant again, even though the least relevant one was the one that they were dealing with. And Oliver and Diggle are following a solid lead to convince Emmy coaching size. I liked all of that. Cool stuff. Tati, go.
I loved Sarah and the Salmon Ladder. It brought great joy to my heart to see that return. And I also loved Felicity's reaction to Sarah and the Salmon Ladder. But overall, I really liked how we got to focus on all the female friendships and all those different interactions felt like they were important and they seemed realistic, even though the show rarely takes advantage of them. I'm glad that they finally did. They brought them all together in this episode. And like you and Tasha have already said, Felicity and Laurel's bond really was the heart of the story here. And seeing Felicity take that optimistic and loyal route and championing Laurel to the others, and eventually, you know, giving a pep talk powerful enough that Dinah and Sarah had to step in and join her with it, was really beautiful, I thought. Also, I was really grateful that Laurel did get talked down in the end and that she went out of her way to stop Shadow Thief and actually protect her friends. So it was nice to see them all on the same side by the end of the episode. I also really liked the scene at Quentin's graveyard, or gravestone, a lot with Sarah and Laurel. I always cry when people talk about Quentin, but I was glad, like we already discussed, like to see Sarah acknowledge her mistakes and talk about her own journey and apply that to Laurel. I thought that was really nice. Speaking of Sarah, I also loved when she realized the bomb didn't go off on time precisely because Laurel didn't actually want to kill them. So that was a nice plot point. loved seeing Laurel in the future, because I remember we were thinking, like, okay, well, she's definitely dead, or she's just not around anymore, or she's off the show. So, thank goodness she showed up. Love that she saved the day. Love that she made an impression on Mia. And I agree with Jeff that the Canary Network is just a nice idea. Like, it's something that Dinah from the comics would definitely do, and it felt right on this show. It felt like it was honoring both Laurels, really. And I loved the opening shot, like how it was all one take. And we've seen that before with James Bamford's directing a lot, but it's usually Oliver that's doing things in one take. And this time it was Laurel, and it was also directed by a woman. So nice! Yay! Okay. Also, I love the whole redemption isn't a destination, it's a journey. It's a great life lesson, and it was well executed in this episode. Plus, it also applied to Oliver and Diggle still not giving up on Emiko, and Oliver trying to make sure that he finds Emiko's mother's killer, and thus brings Emiko back to the light.
I forgot to say that I really liked the, like, Felicity and Sarah flirting after the sermon letter. I thought that was really cute.
Yeah, it was very, very cute. So, May.
Yeah, I really appreciated how much Felicity believed in Laurel and wouldn't give up on her. I think theirs is one of the best developed relationships this season, and it saddens me knowing that they will no longer be sharing any scenes after this. And I like that even though Laurel was technically doing illegal things, she was still using her resources as the DA to go after bad guys, and it wasn't just like random people she decided to hunt down. I also obviously loved how female-focused this episode was and how they all relied on and ultimately had each other's backs. And then Laurel being affected by Quentin's death still was really heartbreaking. And I like that Sarah opened up about not being such a great person back in the day, because I don't know who said it in their feedback, but they're right. She had never apologized for doing the things that she did to her sister. So that was really nice. And I think that is because we now have a female showrunner. Anyway, and I think it really brought perspective and paralleled both of their journeys toward redemption, so both Canaries. And it was also a way for Sarah to help a version of her sister, considering she's always felt so guilty about not being able to bring Laurel, E1 Laurel, back. And I also like that Dinah apologized in the end and that Laurel accepted it, no questions asked. I thought that was a really nice moment. And it made me wish we'd see this girl gang more often. I really like that our theories about... So we had, like, two theories, right? I think one of them was that Laurel was going to die, but then she could go back to Earth 2. But then we're like, what was she doing at Earth 2? But I'm glad that the Earth 2 part did come true and that she didn't actually die. So that was a little nice send-off for her. And also that she came back to help Dinah in the future and gave Mia some advice was really great. Seems like she has her own Canary Network on Earth 2, and I love that for her.
Yeah.
And then finally, I like that Oliver and Diggle had their own side projects and went after Emiko's mom's killer. And I like that Oliver wants to get to the root of the problem and isn't really giving up on his sister just yet. But what did we not like about this episode?
I think while I enjoyed this episode, the future plot was not as great as they have been recently. And I just, like, Mia being all stubborn and I'm going to do what I want to do and not really playing with the team, I just cannot get over the fact that when we saw, like, her origin story, you know, like, she ran away from home. She's only, like, on her own for, what, like, a year? And so I still, there's kind of this, like, disconnect between, for me, like, her attitude is someone that was, like, abandoned or left on their own when they were, like, 9 or 10 and had to, like, really struggle to survive for years. But she, like, found out when she was basically the same age that her mom lied, and so she left. And then a couple months later, she's all, like, tough with, like, tattoos and all. So it's just kind of, like, there's a little bit of disconnect. Like, why are you – I'm sure Felicity didn't raise you like this. So – and you don't have, like, enough –
It feels like she should start – it feels like she should be like Nora in that she needs to learn things.
I just, like, I don't know. It just feels like they're, you know, they're, like, needing to learn things is one thing, but it just feels like she's got, like, a lot of baggage that she didn't necessarily go through, and it doesn't really feel like it is earned the way, like, I can't really connect with how she's acting, because I don't really feel like she went through the kind of experiences that would make that make sense to me. So, yeah, like, she was not her not wanting to play the team and not wanting to do anything didn't really hit with me this week. So we'll see if meeting Laurel inspires her next week to do something different. I don't know. And, yeah, I think that was my main kind of issue with the episode as a whole. Oliver and Diggle, while they moved the plot forward in the background and investigated, they didn't really do anything spectacular with that storyline. Like, it could have just been, like, all women all the time, and I would have been okay. We didn't really get to see Emiko in this episode either, which is kind of weird, since there's a storyline about her, but you don't get to see her, and she wasn't involved in either storyline. And that's all that I can think of right now, but if I think of something else that I didn't like, I will pop up again. So, Tati, go.
Yeah, I thought Shadow Thief was boring as hell. Like, I don't care about her at all. I feel like I understand that Laurel, like if you don't want Laurel to be, like, a big bad, if you want to, like, make her redemption quick and easy, then you have her answering to someone else so that she can turn on them, sure. But it also just kind of makes her look like she doesn't really know what she's doing at any given time. Like, first she's working for Zoom, then she's working for what's-his-face, Diaz, who she would not speak of, and now she's working with Sad with Shadow Thief. I was like, all right, whatever. Moving on. I didn't feel like I needed to see, like, 10 failed pep talks before the one that worked. I was like, okay. Like, so half of the episode, I was like, okay, so it's just, like, people constantly failing to bring Laurel back until they will succeed. So if they had just had, like, the one talk with Felicity at the start and then, like, had a more involved game of cat and mouse wherein Laurel tries to do bad while also tries to avoid killing her friends until that final showdown, would have been fine by me. Also, I was bad. Like you pointed out, that Dinah did not believe her girlfriend. She just assumed the evidence against Laurel was correct.
That's the thing that I was, like, most forgot. My crack ship. Let me talk about my crack ship right quick. Like, Dinah not believing in Laurel, and it wasn't even, like, she didn't even question it that the Laurel that I know, the Laurel that I've been working with, maybe didn't do this. It wasn't even a gray area for her. It was very black and white. And while I understand that, you know, within the episode, there needs to be that one person that's like, no, she can't do it. She hasn't changed. And Felicity's like, yeah, she has, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it just, like, there was no, like, hurt, I'm disappointed, whatever. It was just kind of very cut and dry. And there was wasn't any kind of, I think, like, the writers are trying to punish me for...
for crack shipping?
Like, yeah, for crack shipping them. Like, you know what? We're going to put a stop to this, and we're going to have them not really interact and not be friends at all, and, you know, yeah.
Sad. But yeah, I totally agree that, no, it's fine. It makes sense that she still harbors that pain over Vince, but she is no angel herself, so I'm like, all right, whatever. I did like that Felicity pointed it out. But moving on, the entire future plot, aside from the Canary Network's existence and the fact that Laurel saved Mia, could have been thrown away. Mia's, like, whining even more than Nora does now. Or actually less, but only because she has less screen time, so she can't whine as often as Nora does. and then they also just, like, killed a bunch of canaries and everyone got to meet. And I was like, rude! Like, half the canaries are dead now. I didn't even know they existed. Thanks.
Yeah, and I guess we kind of dropped into, like, that future plot. Like, at first, the previous episode, they were saying, you know, Galaxy One is going to start, and then you get dropped in the middle of the Galaxy One war, and it's like, I don't even know what's going on here, or why.
Right.
How they
found... Yeah, like, how did we get here? Yeah.
Like, they didn't even bring up the Canary Network until this episode, and, like, half the canaries are dead already.
Right. Yeah, they could have seeded that in earlier.
Yeah.
And they could have had Diana said a thing about, like, after what happened to my friend or whatever earlier, so that we could be even more concerned that Laurel would die in this episode. But anyway, moving on. Was there anything else I didn't like? Oh, like you said, we didn't need the boys. They, you know, I guess it's nice that they collected their paycheck. But aside from that, I was like, okay, we get it. We already know that Dante is the one that killed Emiko's mom. And also, isn't Emiko kind of the leader of the Ninth Circle right now anyway? So, like, is she really going to be like, I guess it's her on the Ninth Circle now, thanks? I don't know. We'll see. We'll see.
But they don't know that she's the leader of the Ninth Circle.
Yeah, I know, but we know, so it's kind of like, it's like a moo point. It's like a cow, yeah. Just says moo.
Were those all your dislikes, my dear?
Those are all my dislikes.
Okay. Yeah, I agree about all the pep talks. I think they got in the way of more loaded conversations as to why Laurel should bother going back to being a DA, other than she was, like, doing so well conversations. And then, like, what was it about being good that she actually did like? You know, obviously no one but Felicity supported her, but I don't like how quickly Laurel seemed to forget all the good stuff she's done and went straight to working with Shadow Thief, a character we just met and who didn't add much to the story. It just made it seem like Laurel constantly does need a partner or needs to follow in someone's footsteps on the bad side of things when she's powerful enough to work on her own. And then the flash forwards, like you guys said, they were pretty useless in this episode. And it kind of frustrated me that we are just learning about the entire Canary Network that are being slaughtered left and right. Like, I laughed when Mia thought that she could just go out on her own and take out whoever was doing the killing on her own, as though, like, she was better and had better resources than, you know, an entire network of women who've been doing this for much longer. And it's also weird. It's also a weird follow-up because future Felicity barely spoke two words to the daughter she hasn't seen in a while, and, like, where the hell is William? I don't know. Finally, I also didn't like that Dinah was so quick to believe that Laurel was a lost cause and felt the way Sarah was brought, like Jess said, into the episode wasn't very organic, considering she only had, you know, Laurel looking like her sister to go on. It's not like they interacted much in the last finale, but at least their talk did get better, so there's that. Do we have any predictions? Does Tasha have any predictions?
Did Sarah and Laurel actually meet before this episode? Because I don't remember. Did they meet in the finale?
Yeah, they met in the finale last year during when Quentin was in the hospital.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay. What did Tasha think? Let's speak to the Oracle named Tasha to figure out what's happening.
Tasha, tell us your secrets. Okay. Tasha's predictions are that, in retrospect, Emily leaving the finale makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
They fulfilled her bucket list with this character. Felicity led the charge, captured Diaz, get Oliver out of jail, the flash forwards about her children trying to find her. She got to focus on building Archer and creating smoke tech. Plus, if no one knew about Mia, she had to disappear. Yep. That being said, shows have been known to shoot additional scenes with exiting actors that get archived for later. Okay, so I wouldn't be surprised if she appears in season 8 in all of her flashbacks or dream sequences. I also very much expect she'll make a guest appearance in the series finale. I agree with that. I definitely think season 8 will be primarily flash forwards, with the present-day storyline being used to set up Crisis. Mm-hmm. This is supposed to be their biggest crossover yet. If the Monitor is coming back in the season finale, I think it's because Oliver will be taking on a bit of Harbinger's comic book role. He may be traveling around stopping crimes, hard-traveling hero style, while recruiting additional heroes to fight in the crossover. Oh, okay. That's a pretty cool theory, Tasha. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah. I still think he's dead.
Jess.
Jess is not having it.
She's like, nope, he's gonna die. That's it. It's the end of the
world. I mean, I can still, like, he's still, like, Thanos snap, like, Monitor can bring him to the whatever that plane is, and they can do, like, some universe hopping and recruiting heroes, but I still think that he's going to be dead to the Arrow world. But we'll see. Maybe it'll be a blend of our predictions.
All right. Moving into Legends of Tomorrow. Love is all around. When Mona discovers that her favorite author, Jane Austen, might be the epicenter of a magical alert, Mona, Sarah, Charlie, and Zari find themselves in 1809. With Nate still dealing with family issues, Constantine and Rory perform a seance and receive a message from the other world that rocks Constantine to his core. Meanwhile, Ray and Nora are forced into close quarters. Alexandra LaRoche directed the episode, written by Green, Godfrey, and Jackie Canino. What do we like?
I love Jane Austen, and I love Jane Austen's novels, so I love that she existed. I also liked Mona Short before the characters disappeared on it. I definitely liked Zari getting to, you know, have some focus, have internal exploration, coming to realizations about herself, about her feelings on love, and how her fear of it connects back to her fear of loss and what she experienced in the future past. So all of that was great. It was lovely to see hot immortal dude being into her. And I have, you know, I will say that Nate is a sweet enough bean that I have no moral objections to his union with Zari. Okay? My dislike of
my eyes do. Just kidding.
Yeah, right. My dislike of it is entirely based on just, like, my subjective, I don't want this. But, but there's nothing wrong with Nate, and I think that this episode did a good job of showing that. So that's also good. Meanwhile, I love Ray being apologetic about Nora killing Nate's dad, and Nate being super mature about it, you know, and them just expressing their love for each other, just like two bros do. But on the flip side, Ray then immediately believing Nora when she said she didn't do it, and like feeling like a weight was lifted, right? He's immediately like, oh, thank God. I always believed in you. I thought that was so cute. It was probably like my favorite thing. My favorite thing about the Nate side of the episode. Ray is so pure, and I love him. Meanwhile, I do like how Zari's storyline also just happened to push forward Ray and Nora in the cutest of ways. The dream sequences for almost everyone, not for you, Mona, but for other people, the dream sequences were really funny. I really loved how Nate remains the king of consent, or Ray remains the king of consent during Nora's dream. I guess it was Nora's dream. Because he was like, is this okay? Do you want this? And I was like, yes. Even in sexy lustful dream, Ray is like, I gotta make sure I get enthusiastic consent. And also, of course, the Zari's threesome dream, followed by, this has to be a dream. Like, at first she was like, yeah, this is totally happening. And then Nate showed up and she's like, no, this is fake. This is a dream. That was a mood, as people say. On the flip side, I keep saying on the flip side, but like, in a more depressing side, Nick Zano did manage to get me emotional about Nate and about Hank's death. So kudos to him. He did a good job. I loved Zari trying to comfort Mona and being like, listen, you know, like, you didn't even know Kanani that long, so aren't you a little exaggerated? And I was like, aw. Zari was doing her best. She wanted to make Mona feel better. I also liked that conversation, like, eventually led to her talking with the magical preacher, whose name I have forgotten, Sanjay, I think is his name, about why she fell in love. Yeah. So, yeah, it was sad, but it was also, like, a meaningful revelation for her. And so I'm glad they included that. And Jane Austen's advice to Mona that love isn't about losing control. That was, like, the only Jane Austen-y thing that happened in the episode. And I was like, yes, thank you. That is correct. Jane Austen was like, don't be crazy about love, guys. Be practical. So there we go. Finally, Constantine's discovery about Neron and, you know, how he has, like, taken over Dez's body or whatever was really sad, but it was good. It was a good ending for that. I was like, oh, baby. So yeah, that was good.
Yeah. I think that for me, if I break it down into the different parts on the Nate funeral side, I also liked, you know, Ray being like, feel like he's like caught in the middle, like, my girlfriend killed his dad, but like, he's like my best friend and I don't know how to act. And so like him, like, freaking out and just, like, following Sarah and kissing Nate, and then they'll both be like, wait a minute. Yeah, okay, whatever. That was really cute. I always liked their friendship. And then on the Regency era side of it, I did like that Zari was kind of, like, the center of desire, of the love story or the object of desire, the one that's being courted by two different love interests in this episode. I love that all, like, the girls, there's still kind of, like, a little bit of a girl talk in the beginning with all the girls kind of, like, giving Zari their love advice, and Char's just like, smash, just smash tonight and worry about the rest later. And then, you know, like, everyone's kind of had really interesting advice on Zari's love life, and even, like, when they went back into the Bath, England, and first meet Sanjay, I think it's Kamadeva is the god that he was inhabiting or whatever. And all the girls were seeing how there's, like, sparks flying, and they were, like, encouraging Zari, and I thought that was, like, all really, really cute advice, and them just being, like, good girlfriends. I think, like, visually, the Bollywood sequence with all of the characters and the dress and everything visually looked good, because, I mean, it's Bollywood, so it's going to visually look good, but there's a lot of other stuff that we'll talk about later. Ray and Nora, like Tati, I really liked that. I was kind of concerned in the beginning that he believed that Nora actually killed Hank. I was like, oh, come on, Ray. And so that when she did call him and did get through, and she's like, I didn't kill him, and she didn't take her very long to convince. She's like, I didn't do it. He's like, oh, thank God. So I was like, yes, thank you. And the fact that he was trying to, like, keep her safe on the ship, away from everybody, and the whole dream sequence, I like that as well. Like, they weirdly, like, pushing together, and how they are kind of, like, awkward with each other, and don't really know how to move forward. I thought all of that was really cute. Maybe that's it.
I like that Zari got a lot of heavy focus and the chance to talk about her feelings and share her thoughts on love, or the feelings that she didn't have on love. And I agree with Jess. It was great to see that she was the one on the receiving end of that love and desire, because the last time we really saw anyone be interested in her was Jonah Hex, so I think it's long past due. And I want to make it clear that I don't object to Zari being in a relationship, just that her and Nate came out of left field, and other thoughts that will be my dislikes. I also appreciated that Ray and Nate's bromance is really back, and that Ray actually kissed me on the cheek when he left, and it wasn't too weird for me anyway. I think American society has like a problem with men being affectionate with each other, and I like that Legends tends to normalize that. Ray being so excited that Nora had no part to play in Hank's death was such a sweet reaction, and it was fun watching that the both of them act awkwardly and dance around their feelings while trying to awkwardly share a bed as well. And then Zari's dream of me and Kamadeva, and how the trance of the dance initially started was fun. I also liked all the girl time this episode offered, and the only good part to come out of all the Hank ghosts / funeral stuff was that John learned about Desmond and Neron, so at least that aspect of the plot got to move forward. But what did we not like about the episode?
What did I not like about the episode? I'm a little bit, like, confused, because I feel like I'm like not alone, because like you guys didn't like super love the episode either, but I feel like everyone super loved the episode and like no one had problems with it. So I was like, am it just me? Am I a crazy person? So I don't know if I'm like making up problems or if there really were like issues, but like I for one was a little bit uncomfortable with the way that they had the magical creature fit into the time period, because I was like, oh, it's so cool that they have an Indian coachman, because yes, during that time there was a large South Asian migration to England, you know, and people rarely bring that up. You rarely see brown people in period British stuff, even though they were everywhere. But then the one guy that was there was actually not supposed to be there. He was secretly using the powers of a Hindu god to inspire lust in all the white ladies. And I was like, is that not a thing? Did I just make that up? That's the whole thing? And then also, like, when the revelation came that he had, like, 1,000 wives. Did we need that? Like, was that necessary to show that Zari shouldn't be with some dude who she just met yesterday who is also stealing the powers of a Hindu god? Like, I mean, I feel like we already knew that she shouldn't marry this rando. He didn't need to have 1,000 wives.
Right.
But anyway, also the fact that he's Indian. And that he's, like, you know, Hindu god powers means that Zari's musical choice is Bollywood? Like, why? Why did it mean that her musical choice was Bollywood? Was it even
she
Bollywood?
She was the one that started singing, right?
Yeah, she was the one that started singing. Like, he told her to sing. Because he was like, God loves music. But I was like, I'm sure he didn't love, I mean, he might love Bollywood musicals, but that's not what he was waiting for.
But it wasn't even Bollywood musicals, right? Like,
and I feel like if he started the choice of Bollywood music, then it would be, like, make more sense, because he's leading Zari into his space or his world or whatever.
Yeah. But it didn't even feel like the song didn't even really feel Bollywood-esque, and the dance didn't really feel Bollywood-esque. It was just like a musical number, but everyone was in, you know, traditional outfits, and then suddenly there was a bunch of brown extras, so I was like, okay. And they told us it would be Bollywood. So, and then I didn't really feel that way. So I was like, okay. Like, it could have just been a musical number. You didn't have to make it. Especially because, like, the way that they marketed the episode, I thought, it was like,
Bollywood all the time.
Yeah, but it was really 90% Jane Austen Regency, you know, or someone's like, first day of high school English class idea of Jane Austen before I stood up and said, actually, you are not correct about Jane Austen.
It's Mona's idea.
Exactly.
Jane Austen
idea. Oh, Jane Austen. And then, like, 10% of, you know, Bollywood. But anyway, like, it's not like, the song was nice. I liked that Zari got to perform, and she sounded really, like, a Disney princess, you know, it was really cute. And then I liked that her friends came in, and were like, wait, this is going too far. Like, all that was cute, but I just felt like it was a little bit, like, I don't know, it didn't flow for me. I was like, okay, I feel like they're just doing it so that they can do it. But moving on from that, like Jessica will say, I 100% agree that Austin fits Zari's story more than it does Mona's. And like, it was weird to me that Mona would think that Austin was about, like, letting your heart be carried away by love or whatever. It just didn't make sense. Like, all of Jane Austen's stories are like, that guy you think you're in love with ain't shit. Okay? Crushes, attractions, romance are hashtag fake. You gotta make sure that your woman or your man has a good head on their shoulders, is financially stable, respects you, and treats their servants well before you consider falling for them. Like, literally, Pride and Prejudice, the most famous one, Elizabeth actually says, and actually does, not fall for Darcy until she sees his grounds at Pemberley. She sees how rich he is, how well kept his lands are, and how much the servants like him. And then she's like, you know what? I think I could like him. I think I could do this too.
And
like
how much he loves his sister.
Yes, and how much he likes his sister. That's romance in Jane Austen land, okay? That's romance in Jane Austen land. Finally, like I said, I liked Nate's emotional journey in this episode. I felt really bad for him, but I resented that Zari had to share her episode with him. Like, half the episode was Nate and the ghost thing, the seance section. And I was like, I want a whole Zari episode. So 100% Zari.
We had one of those.
And I want another one. Okay, I want another one. And then the, you know, the ghost part was just a little bit like, I don't know, I feel like it took a really long time to get to where we need to go with that. And also, wait, I totally forgot to mention this at all. Like, the revelation that Hank was creating a freaking theme park for magical creatures, and that was supposed to make us feel better about Hank. Like, Nate was like, oh, that's what he was doing. Okay, well, he had good intentions. And I was like, what?
Fuck that.
Is that what? I was like, so he's just crazy. I mean, he's not like, okay, he wasn't planning on, like, dissecting them and murdering all of them. Great. But he was planning on putting them in little cages and having people come and be like, oh, that's so great. It's like a petting zoo for magical creatures.
That's almost, like, worse. Like, I don't even know, like, how would that be better?
Yeah, I don't know. I was very confused by that.
Yeah.
All right, those are my dislikes.
Yeah. And I'll get back to that in a minute. But I guess, like this episode, I feel like it was all over the place. And they were promoting it as Bollywood, but then it was also in England, and also Jane Austen, and then also Hank died. So there's a funeral. And someone asked, there's a ghost, and it's like a horror story kind of thing. So there's, like, all these different things going on, and none of them really seem to connect very well. Like, I don't really like that the whole purpose of the Kamadeva, Jane Austen, Let Yourself Be Open to Love storyline was mainly to push for Nate and Zari for one, because, like, to what end, for one thing. So it kind of felt like that kind of came out of left, but, like, they're trying to, like, push the gas on that. Like, why does she suddenly need to be in love with Nate now? And I'm still, like, a little bit, who asked for this? Because I certainly didn't. And I'm not really sure to what purpose that they want to have Nate and Zari, other than some kind of emotional fallout later at the end. But, so I didn't really get that choice. I didn't, speaking of romance, like, I don't think Mona has read, like, a Jane Austen novel in her life. And I'm kind of glad that you went first, because I was like, did I, like, not pay attention in English class? Am I wrong? I don't know, but this does not sound like Jane Austen at all. It felt like she was applying this, like, over-the-top romance true love ideas to Jane Austen's novel that I just never, like, learned about in school. Like, maybe I read the book wrong. I don't know. So it was, like, Mona saying that Jane Austen is her favorite author sounds fake to me. And it seemed like a weird choice for this kind of love inspiration storyline for Legends. And I didn't, like, someone mentioned, I think one of our anons mentioned, or someone they saw, maybe they chose Jane Austen because of the Bollywood movie Pride and Prejudice. So I guess that was kind of a connection there. But I felt like I didn't really see how the magical creature coming into this time period gets Jane Austen to stop writing stories. Like, I didn't understand, like, the connection. The story seemed to push Mona with Jane Austen when I felt like Jane Austen would agree with Zari more than she would agree with Mona, so I'm not really sure why Mona had, like, issues. And I guess if you're bringing in a magical creature whose power is to make everybody fall in love and find true love, I'm not sure what the lesson is for Jane. Like, what changed for Jane that she decided not to write any stories? Because it's not like you would think, like, you know, have someone that doesn't believe in love, and then there's this Hindu god that makes everyone fall in love with each other, and then because of the Hindu god, then this whatever famous author runs away and doesn't write or whatever. But that's not kind of what happens. I'm not really sure how Jane was affected to the point that she stopped writing and her books didn't get published. I don't think it was explained well. Like I said earlier, with the choice with the Bollywood musical, I agree that it didn't really sound very Bollywood to me. Like, I wasn't kind of sure, and, you know, it just sounded like they were singing, and then, like, all of a sudden, Bollywood! And it would, I think it would have made more sense if Kamadeva had started it, like, he's trying to show Zari through song, and then she, like, gets into it. I feel like that would have been a better lead-in. Like, Bollywood in the middle of England, but they're not connected. There's a lot of things that felt really disconnected. And then on the funeral side, like, I'm sorry Hank died, but if you're gonna, you know, it felt like they were juggling two balls. That's one ball that they could have dropped and saved for something else. And the whole thing with, like, Hank and him wanting to make a theme park for magical creatures, it just seems like a heavy retcon to make us feel sad for Nate that Hank died. But the whole time, like, the whole first half of the season and up until this point, Hank is like, why would you need to be shady about wanting to open a theme park for magical creatures, first of all? Second of all, they were torturing them. Like, you saw what they did to Konane, and he had the order to, didn't he put out the order to kill Konane when Konane escaped? Or, bring him back, and just, so it's like white man wanting to collect creatures and put them in cages and make them into a zoo, and that's, I'm supposed to think that he's like Walt Disney? it seemed like a stupid choice. Even for a retcon, it seemed just a really dumb thing to try and make me want to feel bad for Hank. So, no.
Plus, it's sometimes just like parents are not, sometimes they're going to disappoint you, and that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay, yeah. Just let him be disappointing.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, I agree. Most of the Hank's funeral ghost storyline just annoyed me. Like, other than Hank's ghost telling John that Neron was the demon behind everything, the subplot didn't really work besides offering Nate some brief closure, which I think he got last episode anyway, with the whole I love you exchange. What I especially had an issue with was that the episode actually absolved Hank of all responsibility and
right.
made it seem like he began working with Neron for the right reasons before plans went sour. But Hank wanting to take the magical creatures and create an amusement park of sorts for them isn't exactly any better. Like Jess said, they're not, you know, first of all, they're not Disney characters, and putting them in a theme park would be trapping them there against their will, and that's not good. So they tried to turn him into this campy dad who only wanted to take his son's theme parks, and that's what he based the whole thing on, and that did feel disingenuous and less interesting for him as a character the way that they introduced him at first. And I agree with Jess that Mona shouldn't have been the character who's most into the Jane Austen novels. Like, I read them too and watched the adaptations, and I don't know if Mona only read the spark notes, but Jane Austen was also very cynical about society and love and all its complicated nature of it. Plus, the whole, like, love defeats all, or whatever, isn't Jane Austen at all. All her characters married rich, so economic status and the levels of classism were both pretty important parts of her books, and ignoring that just to focus on the romance did Jane Austen as an author a disservice.
I think for, like, it would have made more sense if Jane Austen was Zari's, you know, go-to author, and she could use, like, Jane Austen as an example, and then something happens where Jane Austen's books start disappearing. That would have made more sense. I thought, like, the whole, I forgot to say this, are really, like, pointed out, but when Mona hulked out and went to Jane Austen, like, you made me stop believing in love, I thought that was the dumbest scene ever. I even heard in my notes, like, this is stupid.
Yeah, I agree with that. I completely blanked on the whole part that she did Hulk out because I forgot that happened. And this might, I don't know if this is an unpopular opinion or not, but I liked it better when Mona was at the bureau. I don't know I don't know that any of the legends know her well enough at this point for that fight between her and Zari to even have happened, much less escalated the way that it did. And I know it's legends and we're supposed to go with the flow, but the episodes in 4B haven't been entertaining enough for me personally to skip over the issues that have been happening over the last three episodes. And, like, the shift towards Mona being at the center of the magical creature stuff continues to be frustrating when Charlie is still right there and she's been underutilized for three episodes now, because Mona isn't compelling enough yet to drive the story, and the shift is really jarring for me. And then Zari being a bit of a cynic is one of my favorite things about her, actually, and she can also be hopeful and open sometimes, but I do dislike that we got all this development for her in service of her relationship with Nate, which is still so random and unnecessary, no matter how much Tati thinks Nate is a beautiful summer child. I don't begrudge Zari getting this focus.
I'm not saying I support support the ship. I'm just saying there's nothing wrong with Nate. So I unfortunately cannot claim the higher moral ground when I oppose the ship.
Noted. I don't begrudge Zari getting this focus, but I think it's a shame that the writers didn't think to do it before she started having feelings for Nate, and I think they honestly do see Nate as more of their leading man than Rey, and this episode is somewhat of a product of that line of thinking.
Oh.
Yes.
Finish, and then I have something that I forgot that I want to add, but go ahead.
Okay. And the Commandeva was also, I feel like he was really shoehorned in for all the reasons that you guys already stated. Like, he was a great character, but he deserved a whole episode dedicated to him instead of having to share that with Jane. The musical number wasn't really Bollywood either, I agree. Like, just dancing that kind of happened to be done while wearing Indian clothing, and I don't like that they used the Hindu god of love in a Regency setting to begin with, because it becomes like a lot of British media, right? Like, they allude to having a large South Asian population, but rarely do they include them in narratives, which is what kind of happened here. And then finally, I was mostly bored by the funeral subplot and the haunting of Hank, and wish they found another way for Constantine to get information about what Neron was up to. Like, the whole ghost could have happened on the ship, I don't know.
Oh, yeah. The one thing, because when you mentioned, like, Nate being the leading man and, like, romance and all that kind of stuff, one thing that felt really odd to me, that in a episode about romance and losing control and being with the one you love, the anchor ship of the show, Avalan, is not mentioned at all. Sarah has no feelings about what's going on with Hindu God of Love and we haven't seen Ava in, like, two episodes. And so, you know, Rey and Nora, as the beta ship, got to move forward. That's really odd that there was no mention of, like, Sarah had a dream about Ava, and that was great, but that didn't really lead to any kind of update on Ava and Sarah. And since Ava's not there, she can't really say anything about it. So I thought that was really weird that in an episode that was focused on true love and finding romance and doing it all for the love of somebody else, that there was no kind of commentary on Avalanche and what was going on there. So I thought that was odd.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Predictions. Do we have any?
Well, when the legends learn that Nora is on the ship, there could be some predictions about that, I think. But not really.
Yeah, I think that it'll just be that I'm going to predict that by the end of the season, they can bring Des back somehow. And Constantine can have a little happy ending and maybe leave. Because, I don't know, he just feels like not a permanent character.
Des or John?
Well, Des, obviously, but I meant John. Although he doesn't happily. He could just have him happily ensconced at home, like Sarah does with Ava. But but I feel like Constantine, like, he has, like, a very specific arc, you know?
Yeah.
So,
I agree with that. All right. Side A, Lady with Gumption nominee. Who are we picking?
I would posit Felicity for Arrow.
Yeah.
For having that gumption to stick to her guns about Laurel's redemption and stand up to Laurel and all her friends. How about for Legends? Would we say Zari for throwing it all away and then taking it back?
Yeah. Because I think Zari was in control of her whole story, and up until the point where she was, like, hypnotized by the Hindu god, but even through that, I guess, like, her Legends ladies deserve, like, an assist for helping her snap out of it, and her finally, like, you have 1,000 lives? No, thank you, kind of thing. But I think it was, like, Zari focused, so I would agree with that. Felicity and Zari for side A.
All right. Lovely.
Done.
Moving into side B, Litter Runner / False God, we will start with The Flash. After discovering that Nora is working with Thawne, Barry and Iris disagree about how to handle their daughter in the wake of this shocking news. Team Flash isn't sure they can trust Nora, so they... Barry really can't figure out if he can trust Nora, so they go through her journal to find out exactly how she came to work alongside their greatest nemesis, a.k.a. Barry's greatest nemesis. Danielle Panabaker directed the episode written by Judalina Neera and Kelly Wheeler. What did we like about this episode?
Well, I guess, like, this is also kind of like Arrow in that it was an all-women-on-deck episode, in front and behind the camera. So that was, that's kudos for that. Two snaps. I guess the thing that I liked most about this episode is that it was Nora's pilot episode almost, and there's all the direct callbacks to the pilot and the parallels between Barry and Nora in this episode. Like when in front she's like running because she's late to a crime scene, and she has her own like boss that's kind of like, come on, West Allen, let's go, let's go, let's go. That was kind of like a parallel back to Barry when he was on his first crime scene, when she's getting out of the, waking up from her, being unconscious to poker face, and everything, even with like the childhood friend dynamic between Barry and Iris and Nora and Leah. I even love like even those relationships seem to kind of parallel each other up into, even up to the point that their villain killed the love of their life. Well, it's just kind of sad. There's like dark humor there, but yeah, I loved all of that kind of parallels, and I love it so much of it was taking place in the future, and that we got to learn a bit more about Nora and see more of her story as kind of like three-dimensional kind of thing. And I liked that choice, and that it wasn't just everybody in Star Labs reading, decrypting the journal and reading it. We didn't have to see that. It was all told through the flashbacks, the flash-forward flashbacks of Nora's life there. I really love Leah as a character. I thought she was really sweet, and I liked her and Nora's dynamic and their friendship. I liked that they kind of, you know, geek out together. They were really cute. And like I said, I feel like there's a lot of similarities and parallels between Leah and Nora and Barry with Iris. And that they didn't really kind of hint that there was something. It seemed like
there totally was some of it.
Yeah. It seemed definitely on Leah's side that there just totally was something. I wish that it had been a little bit more explicit than it was, but I really enjoyed them together. I love getting to see future Iris. She looks good. Baby looks good. Black don't crack. And I like that. Even before that, when she was in Coast City and the call between Nora and her mom, and just kind of seeing how their dynamic was, and it really made sense, because we had all these kind of theories about the dampening chip and how she found out and was it Vaughn and all this kind of thing, but the way that they unraveled how it happened in this episode, it made sense why she would be upset. And how that all came out. And I like how Iris said that everyone knew. I was like, who is everyone? Like, I need notes. Who is around in the future that she told this secret to, not to tell you? But they kept that close to the chest, I guess, because of crisis. The whole sequence, and it kind of made sense. Like, the other question was how does Nora get to work with Vaughn? Like, how did she get to that point where she was working with Vaughn? There's all these kind of, like, theories about that. But I think even that, the way that they set it up with her being presented with an evil speedster and not knowing how to approach it, let me go to this evil speedster, not knowing that, you know, that her father is a Flash, or that Reverse Flash is Barry's, like, greatest enemy, not knowing all that, and then getting to developing this kind of like relationship because she needs him to help defeat Godspeed, and all of that I think was explained pretty well in this episode. I like that in the present, once they got to a certain point in the journal, Iris is like, look, she gave me a second chance to get to know Nora. I'm going to give her a second chance. So I do like that it was Iris that let Nora out and gave her that opportunity to speak for herself, and that she really had like trust and belief in her daughter. I'm gonna stop and I'm gonna let somebody else talk.
I really liked the glimpses that we got of Nora's previous life, of the future that is Nora's past, and as you said, I love Leah as a character. She was like a fun kind of like a female Cisco, or like a chill Mona, and I like what we saw of Iris in the future. I like that she was like your average overprotective, nervous mother, you know, who's still very, very caring and like, you know, always checking out on her daughter. And outside of the life-altering secret that she kept, their dynamic did feel very familiar to me. First off, it's super realistic that Iris still looks bomb at 60. Totally agree with this. Only changes a few silver streaks. Gorgeous and accurate. Also interesting to compare that average behavior of Nora's, where she's, like, being dismissive of her mother and, like, being annoyed that she's constantly calling her, but, like, in a very, like, teenage young adult way, with, like, the change that took place when she actually learned the truth, right? When she learned about her powers and she learned her mother kept them from her. And then, like, you see the actual angst, which was really well done. I thought Candace and Jessica did a really good job in that scene, and I felt so bad for Iris. I liked that Iris wasn't vilified for what she did. It's a far cry from the way that Nora painted the storyline when she first talked about it, but at the same time, it's totally understandable why Nora did, because she was in such, like, an emotionally distraught place, and she was very, you know, confused. Like, a bunch of things happened at once. Like, the first speedster shows up in 25 years, and then suddenly she's also got speed, and then her best friend is dead, and she started working with Thawne, which also made sense, right? Like, it made sense. She doesn't know the personal history of Thawne and her family because no one knows that Barry is a Flash, and therefore the Flash Museum just has Reverse Flash as just another villain speedster, right? So that made sense. She was like, well, you know, between, like, he's obviously the lesser evil in this case because he's in jail and not running around killing people. And it was perfectly, you know, it just so happens that when she comes in, the guard is like, I guess I'm going to torture the prisoner, you know? And like, oh, he's only got an hour to live. Like, all this stuff that, like, was just perfectly placed for Nora to feel bad for Thawne and to feel like she can trust him to help her. So I thought the episode did a really good job of explaining that connection. Also, as much as I didn't like that Leah died, like, I agree with people saying, like, she could have just been so seriously injured, I did think that they used that very well to push Nora forward. Wish it hadn't happened, though. We can talk about dislikes. But anyway, I liked how Iris handled things in the present. I agree that she was, you know, it just makes sense for her to give Nora a second chance. And it's nice to see even just a little glimpse of how much stronger of a bond they have in the present than they did in the future. It was a nice little, not a parallel, but whatever. Whatever you call it.
I kind of wish they had held hands in that scene. Like, she lets her out and then they go into the cortex. That felt like a hand-holding moment.
That would be cute. I agree. That would be cute.
Mr.
Edgar. Protect you from the fall.
Have you hold hands.
I also liked the pilot. There's a lot of pilot callbacks, like you already said. It was really nice. It really did feel like this was XS's origin story pilot episode. You really did see how she was, you know, she really was Barry's daughter.
I forgot, like, the power activating, because, like, Iris and Barry and Jitters, and then Leah and Nora, like, she drops the thing, and then, you know, down to the whole running into a laundry truck, being crazy speed, all of that.
Yeah, so that was really great. There was a lot of nice little touches there that took us back to the pilot. KJ actually said, oh, that reminds me of, you know, that could have been the 100th episode, and, like, that kind of stuff. Like, if we had Nora's origin story in, you know, with a combination of more stuff from the main characters, then I do agree with that. But anyway, overall, I thought it was a good episode. It was exciting. It gave us a new perspective on Nora. And the fact that the whole team was learning about it while we were was also great. Killing two birds with one stone, like you said, they didn't have to, like, learn the information themselves or read through the diary, whatever. We were seeing it in real time as they were learning it to get rid of exposition dumps. So that was great. May?
I agree with all of this. I also really liked all the callbacks to the pilot episode. I also liked seeing Leah and Nora's friendship / potential, whatever potential that was lost there, because it nicely paralleled Barry and Iris' friendship back in the day. Nora being obsessed with her dad's disappearance was on brand, and I liked that not the disappearance, but like when she had the little board or whatever.
Yeah, like the one case her dad couldn't solve.
Yeah, exactly. And I remembered that she didn't know he was the Flash, so it was about Cicada. And I like that we got to see some of the everyday stuff that she dealt with. And I agree with whoever wrote that we actually got out of Star Labs. Like, we got to see the city again. The city was a character in the story once more. And that included the relationship she had with Iris prior to her finding out about the chip. And I also agree, it was pretty normal. Iris was being seemed super protective. Like, she always wanted to know what Nora was doing, that she was safe type mom, you know. I agree future Iris was still looking fabulous, which shouldn't be a surprise, but she did fare better than future Barry, so that's something. And I think Jessica Parker Kennedy did a great job conveying Nora's emotions at every turn, because she had to go from a regular adult with a job to someone who realized she had powers and her dad was a Flash all in one episode. So I think she did really well with that, especially since, like, the episode focused on her very much. And they thankfully made the reasons for her going to Eobard make sense, and then made it so that we understood why she took up working with him and couldn't stop. And I admit to feeling a bit, I felt a lot bad for her, actually, like, after everything she'd been through. But I do like that Barry at least got to ask why she continued working with Thawn after finding out he'd killed her grandma and other things like he'd done. I think it was a valid question and something all of us have been wondering, because that part didn't seem to make sense up until this episode. And I liked Barry's message to Nora. I thought it was really heartbreaking and very emotional. And then finally, I liked that Iris was the one to let Nora out of her cell, and thought it was smart that she wanted to hear the rest of Nora's story from her and not her notebook, because everyone should have a chance to explain themselves. I think it was very in character for Iris to want to believe the best in someone and give them a chance to explain themselves, considering, you know, what she said about Nora giving her a second chance. And I also like that she dragged Sherlock briefly, especially since she told him to back off her daughter before, and when she'd asked, he didn't even bother telling her why he was investigating her to begin with. And though I thought Barry's actions were extreme, which I'll discuss in the dislikes, it was nice to finally see him truly react to something, because it feels like it's been a while since he has. I think we're finally seeing his story and conflict with Nora play out versus what Iris and Nora's conflict at the beginning of the season was. And I think his scene with Thawn in the post-credits scene was really intense, and I felt like the anger and hostility. And I think that what this episode did more than anything was reinvigorate the show a bit and make it so, like, I'm looking forward to next week's episode, which hasn't been the case in a while, so that's really nice. But what did we not like about the episode?
I will throw in my likes. I agree with you, because I forgot to mention that, but Barry's, like, goodbye message to Nora is really heartbreaking. I thought it was really well played between both Grant and Jessica Parker Kennedy. And I agreed with, you know, up until the part where he ran her back into the future. I agree with Barry. Like, those are some valid points. Like, some points were made there, because that's what we were all thinking about. You know, yeah, up until that point, you didn't know, so okay. But now you know that what Thawn has done and then the full scope of it, so why did you still continue working with him? I thought that was a good question that she should have been able to answer. But as far as what we didn't like, I didn't like what happened after that. I thought it was very out of character for Barry. Like, this was not Barry. Like, Barry, like, wanted to forgive the evil version of himself. He wanted to forgive Savitar and for killing Iris and actually, like, bring him back on the team. Like, this is Barry, like, all villains can change Alan. Like, Barry, I'm going to try and convince the serial killer, Cicada, metahuman serial killer, to take a drug to take away their serial killing powers, because all people can change and all people are hope and love and rainbows and all this other stuff. Alan, and, you know, like, this is your daughter. And you know how manipulative that Thawn can be. And so to, you know, I would understand if he puts her in, he grounds her in the present. Like, you cannot be on my team or whatever. I understand him being, like, mad and disappointed, but not to the point where you throw your daughter away. And he basically, like, threw her away. Like, he put her in the future. He's like, I don't want to be with you. I don't want you in my life. Don't come back. And I just think that's just so out of character. And then the fact that he made everyone leave the room, including Iris, didn't consult her, just did it kind of impulsively, knowing, like, from the beginning of the season, like, Iris wanting to get to know her daughter and the kind of build up. And even, like, in the beginning, like, Nora, you backed the wrong parent.
She didn't realize the one she wanted to even love didn't love
the
her
one
like
didn't love her. Even in the beginning, like, in the series, season premiere, like, Barry didn't want her there, and now, like, he's, like, throwing her away in the future. Like, can you imagine, like, your parent has been dead all your life. You finally get this one opportunity to go back and spend time with them and be around them. And then all of a sudden, they don't want you. And it's kind of like, you know, I guess with Barry, when he met the real Jay Garrick, and the real Jay Garrick has his dad's face, but Jay Garrick's like, I'm not your dad. Like, put that wall up. We are not family kind of thing. So it's just really, I don't understand why he would go to that kind of length for his own child. And even afterwards, he did go to Thawne, and he did, you know, have that kind of conversation and out with Thawne about what Thawne did and how he took both his mother and his daughter. But, like, you also left your daughter in the future. Like, that was your choice to say, like, we're going to do this differently, and you're not going to talk to Thawne anymore and all that kind of stuff. But so it just really doesn't make sense to me why he would leave her there and not talk to Iris about it, not talk to anybody about it, just kind of do his own thing, and why he thought that that would be okay. So, yeah.
Maybe he thought, like, well, we'll conceive a new child and we'll raise her differently.
Or he's like, I'm not having sex again, so I'm sure that I'm going to see Nora. I don't know, but it was just, yeah, it was ugly. I didn't like it.
Yeah.
Oh. Mm-hmm. And then there's also something about the future storyline that I didn't like. Oh, Godspeed.
Yeah.
The episode being called Godspeed, Godspeed being a huge character in the comics and from, like, the New 52, and there's so much there, and the only thing that seemed to be on track with the comics was that Godspeed was Augustus Hart, and that was it. Just kind of being reducing him to, like, a junkie, a one-off villain that they, you know, I don't know if he'll come back at some point, but it just kind of seemed like one of our feedback listeners said that it could have been done with some other villain at not named Godspeed.
Yeah, like Cobalt Blue.
Like Cobalt Blue or Inertia. There's, like, a lot more that could have been done with Godspeed and to actually make him a Thawne for Nora that I don't really think they didn't do a lot with.
Cobalt would have been better because he is a Thawne, and then it'll be even more of a connection when he turns out that my prediction is right.
Yeah.
As is your dislikes, dear.
That's about it, I think. And I guess, like, I do agree that, you know, I understand the Leah having to die, because, like I said, like, in my likes, it's still, like, a parallel with Barry having to watch Iris die and how that changed him so drastically, and so Leah is kind of Nora's Iris and watching her die and that kind of kicking off her story, but also, I didn't want Leah to die, so it is kind of...
Don't worry. Leah's not really going to die, because Nora's going to get a raise, so it'll be fine.
She will exist once again.
Exactly. Yeah, I totally agree. Godspeed was dumb. The only thing, I was sad because at first, I was like, when I saw the costume, I was like, oh, cool, he looks like Godspeed, great. And then they said his name was Augustus Hart, and I was like, oh, are they really going to do Godspeed? No, nothing else is the same. They made him some, like, scientist. He doesn't even have the Speed Force. He just has Velocity 9. He just, like, comes in and sweeps by and then goes away.
After, like, so many years, is Velocity 9 once again relevant?
Right. Well, wouldn't it be, like, Velocity 22 by now? Like, come on. Y'all went through the step we'll take to get there. But anyway, whatever. It was just, like, a waste of a pretty big name villain, like you guys said. Like, even though he was just created a few years ago, he's, like, the most iconic villain from the Rebirth phase. So it's just, like a waste. It's just a waste. Boo you whore. I saw Joshua Williamson tweet, like, oh, it was so cool to see Godspeed on live action. And I was like, oh, don't lie, honey. You were probably like, wow, they totally ruined my story. But he collected his check, and that's what matters. They were like, here's your money. We used Godspeed. I was like, oh, I love that. Anyway, Eobard's accent was, like, wavering into Sherlock sometimes.
Yes.
First off, yeah, he didn't sound like he did in season one to begin with. Still doing the Batman whisper, and then sometimes he had a French accent. And I was like, Tom has too many roles. He's clearly, like,
it doesn't match.
Also, Sherlock butting into the West Allen convo was so annoying, but it's, like, understandable, because they shouldn't have been having that conversation there in the first place. It should be invited. At this point, it is truly ridiculous that West Allen cannot have solo scenes. I don't understand why. Especially when he does know how to clear the room so he can talk to Nora so he can throw her back to the future. So you'd think he'd be able to clear the room to talk to his wife at some point. But no, it does not happen. That was my biggest problem with the episode, of course. Barry's choice to kick Nora back to the future. It was just, it was so ugly. Obviously, the fact that he didn't talk about it with Iris before, and he didn't even think, like, even though he had just heard, like, the previous episode, I think, or two episodes ago, how sad Iris was to part with Nora soon, and how she wanted to do all this whole list of things before they went, and she wanted to have a big goodbye party and whatever. You know, he knows how much Iris wants to spend time with Nora, and how guilty she feels about their strained relationship and whatnot. So I think it's just garbage that he was like, well, I'm just going to throw her out, and then Iris can deal with it later. Like, whatever. He is stupid. And also, the fact that he's just guaranteeing that she's going to fall further into Aelar's clutches, it's just like, how dumb are you, Barry? Like, why would you alienate your daughter when the only, as far as she knows, the only lifeline she has in her time is Aelar, and you just left her there with Aelar? Like, what do you think is going to happen? I don't know. So yeah, I really hated it. He's dumb. And I cannot wait for Iris to yell at him next week. Finally, yes, like, the future looked kind of cool. And I do think it's cool that, like, both Danielle and Tom, their directorial debuts on Flash were, like, creating a new time period. Or alternate universe, what I'm gonna call it, because Tom's directorial debut was 319, with 2024. And now Danielle's 2049, so that's cool. But I still don't understand, and I'm still salty about the fact that we don't get the future that was teased by Zari with Nora. Like, they're so close in time, and there's no reason to believe they don't come from the same timeline yet, because neither one has reset the time. So I don't know why they wouldn't have that. Plus, like you mentioned already, Cicada, right? Cicada's still on the loose, and yet there's, like, no mention of that.
That was one thing that kind of surprised me when we went 24/9 that it was so bright. It was very positive and very bright.
Which is not at all what I would have expected.
Yeah.
A friend, Cammy, she said that, like, it just makes it seem like Barry or Flash was unnecessary. Because it seems like they're doing just fine without the Flash. Or without features of any kind. And it's very, very different from what Central City was like without Iris. You know? So it's very weird. Yeah, it's just very strange. Like, I guess, you know, Barry died in Crisis, and he, like, saved everyone. He saved the world. Everything's great.
Yeah, that is a good point, because it does seem like the world moved on and was okay without Barry. Like, you would think. And I guess, I don't know if that's, I guess that could be the director on Danielle, if he had to say one thing, because I think she did, you know, an adequate job. There's not a lot of, like, choices about the directing that I would say were, like, weird or odd, but I guess if you do want to say one thing, the 2049 world and the atmosphere of the world, it probably could have been a little darker or a little grittier, just to kind of, because it is post-crisis. I guess it's several years post-crisis. I guess maybe at some point the world healed, but I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
So that's that on my dislike.
Yeah. I agree with a lot of your dislikes, given that most of the team said a line each at most. I don't understand why Barry and Iris couldn't have chatted about their daughter's actions in the hallway or something. Like, I don't know. Instead, the rest of the team was standing around awkwardly while Barry raised his voice at Iris in front of everyone, which was not cool, but thankfully it didn't last long, before they dragged Turlok, who was a complete asshole during a sensitive situation. I think that the fact that the entire team was privy to Nora's journal still rubs me the wrong way, and I didn't like the fact that Barry deceptively asked for the room to speak with her, knowing full well what he was going to do after and didn't think about what Iris would want, just like you guys said. Like, that should have been a decision made by the both of them, but he's acting up again because he's only thinking about his feelings and how this affects him, and not how his disappearance and everything after that played into why Nora was working with Thawne to begin with. Which brings me to a season-long dislike that over the show's inability to address Barry's disappearance head on and make it so that was his story this year. Like, how to remain in his family's life, how to possibly stop it from happening, or at least, like, caring that it does, and the aftermath of what it means for his family. Like, Barry in the future message seemed more concerned with what would happen to Nora, and I'd like to see more of that Barry in the present. Also, sending Laura back to the future and his half-hearted goodbye to her was really cold and even worse than locking her up in the cell. Like, he could have just been like, I'm going to zap your speed away or something. And that was that. You can't go back to talk fun.
Put the dampener chip back in or
something. Yeah, exactly. Ooh, yes, exactly. But, like, what he did, it was really cruel and brutal and kind of, like, unforgiving because he knows what Nora went through to get to know him. And I think what he did showed her that he clearly is putting himself first in the situation, which goes against, like, how the way that he was talking to Cicada in a previous episode about, like, loving his daughter and how much he feels about her and blah, blah, blah. And I also don't think we got to see enough of how Barry, like you guys said, not being in the future actually affects anyone, which is in part another issue that they could have explored over the course of the season. Because at this point, season 5, Barry isn't really centered in the story about his own future, which is really depressing. Anyway, moving on. I know why Leah died. Doesn't mean I like the fact that they used death to propel Nora's story forward, but I agree that she will be back in the new future. I also thought Godspeed was a lousy meta of the week, and his entire presence was really limited and lame, considering his backstory in the comics, and then they went and made him a Velocity 9 junkie, which was really lazy, because it was lazy the first time they tried to do it in season 2. And I think he could have been a season-long villain, but they made him a one-off, which was really disappointing. And while I liked this episode overall, I do think it should have come a little bit earlier, and it didn't do much to move the larger plot forward, at least like the Cicada stuff, because like Jess said, they didn't even mention Cicada in 2049. And then I 100% agree with Eobard sounding more like Sherlock. Like, it bothered me while I was watching. First it was the raspiness, then it was starting to sway into French accent territory, and it made me really wish we had Matt back, because Tom is getting lazy in his portrayal, and it's really bothering me. But anyway, moving into predictions, do we have any?
Didn't Danielle say that, I think she said on Twitter that, I don't know if it was all of Tom's scenes or just, like, the prison scenes, but they did them all in, like, one day. Mm-hmm. So Tom had, like, a really heavy day or a day and a half. I don't know how long it was, but I don't know if it was just those prison scenes or if he had other character scenes in different places, but I wonder if that probably bled into the reason why his accent was, like, all over the place.
You maybe know what that means? That just means he's doing too much.
He's playing too many characters, yeah, definitely.
So predictions.
Predictions! Well, I predict that this whole season came about because Eobard was salty that he doesn't have a big enough wing in the Flash Museum, and that his, like, because Nora told him that his there wasn't any information about him, so he's like, oh, really? And so I think this whole season yeah. was because he wanted a bigger legacy in the Flash Museum.
And I love it.
Something that Barry stopped. Yeah, and I think yeah. that he, even from the, he, like, I think he orchestrated Leah's death, to be honest.
Yes, that is my theory, is that Godspeed was sent by, planted by Eobard as a way to draw Nora in. And, yes, so therefore all the events since then have been orchestrated, including he's like Lex Luthor, like he owns the prison guards,
yes,
basically, you know,
yes.
kind of situation. So that would be my theory, or my prediction.
Yeah, and I also think Eobard will break out by the end of episode 20 at the earliest to come to the present and finish whatever plan he started when he began manipulating Nora. And I think Barry and Iris will make up by the end of next episode, but it'll take until the end of episode 20 for Barry to fully forgive Nora, which is right on time for Eobard's arrival.
Oh, that's good. And I think, I don't know if it was in Anon or on Twitter or someone was saying, suggesting that maybe, like, the girl, because is 21 still called the girl with the red lightning?
Yeah.
Did Canadian Twitter lie to us? It's called the girl with the red lightning?
It is, yeah.
Okay. And so there is, like, a theory that that could be Leah, so, like, Leah's not dead. Or, like, all of the changes that Nora has been doing in the past is enough to change it so that Leah is alive. And I don't know, maybe Leah took Velocity 9 or 22 or whatever, and now she's also a speedster. Because, like, you remember in the flashbacks, there is that one, like, Catherine Gallagher looked really great in that red ensemble. So she had, like, the dark red sweatshirt and, like, the red pants. And then 21 is the girl with the red lightning, so maybe. Either that, or it's like Eobard's, like, new grandchild.
Maybe. All right. Moving into Doom Patrol. Vic and Rita find the mansion infiltrated by Ernest Franklin, a dangerous man called the Beard Hunter, who's been activated by the Bureau of Normalcy to find Niles Calder. Meanwhile, we learn the tragic love story between Calder and an immortal woman named Slava that started Niles on the path towards the man we know today. What, if anything, did we like about this episode?
Tati?
If anything, LOL. I like that we got to check in with Vic and with Rita, because I was concerned about that last week. I like how this episode further solidifies their little friendship. It's nice that we're getting a little bit more, like, a few more subunits other than just Jane and Robot Man. And I'm glad that we're dealing a little bit more with Vic's potential future from the painting. I thought that the Bureau of Normalcy backstory was interesting. And I was glad to get some explanations, you know, we're not all the way there yet, for, like, how Niles can be immortal. And it was interesting to know that he used to be part of the Bureau of Oddity, right? So that was like, a cool little tidbit that it used to be the Bureau of Oddities, became the Bureau of Normalcy, and that Niles has been fooling them since, like, 1917 or whatever. The Beard Hunter guy was super weird and gross, but he was kind of funny, and he actually provided, like, some interesting story progression. And at the end, when we realized that he, you know, he discovered that, like, the wolf thing was, like, there, so it's like Niles actually didn't leave Slava behind, maybe? So that was, like, an interesting revelation for the future. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, that's pretty much sums up the episode, I think, like, Vic and Rita getting to have their own kind of adventure, because that was one of the dislikes that we had about last week, is that we didn't really get to see what anybody else was doing, so I'm glad that we could see what else was going on while Cliff was in Jane's mind, and that they are dealing with the potential, like, you get to see more of whatever's going on with Cyborg, and I couldn't tell if it was Beard Hunter manipulating Cyborg's machinery, or if it was Silas, or what was going on, but seeing that Vic is not completely in control of his systems, and him realizing that, and how dangerous that could be for the rest of the team, I thought it was, like, an interesting way to continue to push his story further, and I also agree that it was interesting to see how the Bureau of Normalcy came about, and for it to go from Bureau of Oddities, which Niles was a part of, to and I don't know if they're, because he said that they were, like, explorers, so I don't really know what they were exploring so much. Like, is it going to be like Hank, where they want to take them back and have a theme park of magical oddities, or I don't know what the purpose of the Bureau of Oddities were. But then I guess over the course of the Great Year and the Great War, and seeing how that changed the perspectives from being, like, a group of explorers to a group of, like, Nazis almost, like, eradicating things for being different. I thought that was interesting how that kind of evolved and how it went from normalcy, from oddity to normalcy, that flip. And then the Beard Hunter, when he was introduced to the story, I was like, did we get thrown into the 80s? But then it said, like, 2019, I'm like, what is going on? And then, that thought it provided some comedy. And he was weird, like, he was, like, the most loser-looking guy ever. But his powers, as gross as they were actually kind of, made him kind of formidable, which I thought was interesting, considering, you know, it's like, looks can be deceiving kind of thing. But when he did have, like, the essence, and that was the way that, Vic was like, they're back the hell up. He was, like, looking at, like, Vic's beard. I thought it was really funny. And the fact that when he did, was then able to inhale Vic's essence or whatever through that one beard hair, and how that made him such a powerful adversary, I thought was really kind of interesting. Just like a random power, but it made him really powerful. And then at the end, when he actually does find something connected to Niles, if it's not necessarily Niles, but I guess it's Lava, and having that come back into play, in kind of a really present way, and that kind of kicking off a new mystery to Niles, like you unveil like a new layer. And I also thought it was really interesting that Beard Hunter kept dropping all these hints, like, I know who you are, I know who Niles is, and you're not good guys or something like that. And so I thought that was really, you know, all these little like tidbits are being dropped for future stories. So I like the way that they set that up.
Yeah, and I think him having a, you know, Vic's essence is why I thought that he was controlling him, because that's what it did seem like. What I did like was that we finally got more of Niles' backstory. He's kind of been a mystery for most of this season. And
you like that?
I mean, I didn't like the backstory, but I like that we got
you
backstory.
Live like that?
And, like, a reason as to why he eventually will not age, right? Like, I dramatically say it's been 84 years, but on this show, like, it actually has been that long or more. I did find it surprising that he worked for the Bureau of Oddities, like you both did. But I think it made sense because he'd always been looking for people who stand out. The fact that he was an explorer with the Bureau was reminiscent of, you know, pre-World War I era where they were white guys are going into, like, Amazon trying to find shit.
Right.
And I like that we got the backstory as to how the Bureau became the Bureau of Normalcy and how their tactics changed completely from what they had been. And I know last week we did wonder why Rita and Vic didn't go on the adventure into Jane's mind, so I like that this episode filled in the blanks of what they were up to while the rest of their team members were out, and I like that we learned a little bit more about, like, what's going on with Vic and the fear he has that he could actually hurt the rest of his friends like he did in Jane's painting, and agreed that I like the furthering of his and Rita's friendship, which has been an interesting journey from how they started out. What do we not like?
I didn't like Niles. He definitely did not make endear him to me. I thought he was a huge asshole. He was totally disrespectful towards Slava. And, like, just automatically assuming that she was, like, I don't know, holding him hostage or, like, trying to make him her pet when that's literally what he does, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's the most, like, ironic thing about it. Like, he gets so affronted that he thinks that she wants him as a pet when his whole purpose for being out there was to capture her and bring her back to for people to ooh and ah at. And, you know, it's just dumb.
Yeah. So I didn't like that. And then, I don't know, I guess, like, it felt like the narrative, too, like, it didn't do a very good job of exploring her perspective at all. Like, considering that he ended up staying with her for years, I think that they could have easily found a way to communicate and shown us how they communicated so that we could know what she was thinking, you know?
Yeah.
So I didn't like that. I didn't like that the way that they interpreted her or incorporated her. Also, I don't feel like it needed to be romantic, especially since we did not get any communication between them. Mm-hmm. So, like, I feel like it could have just been, like, survival and they became friends and then he wanted to protect her because he realized she was a person and not an object. That would have been just fine. So making it romantic was also unnecessary in my eyes. And then the idea, I don't know, even what's his face saying, like, oh, you're doing all this to protect her, you know? Like, I know your secret. And I was like, all of this? The Doom Patrol to protect her? What? How? So, I don't know. I guess we'll see. We'll see what that means. But I was not feeling it. On the other side, on the Vic and Rita side, I liked the whole thing with Beard Hunter, but I still feel like they're not delving into the potential future enough. You know, I feel like of what Vic might be dealing with the fact that he's not in charge. I feel like there's always, like, other things in the way of dealing with that. So I would like to have an episode that's all focused on Vic soon enough, because I feel like he's probably the one getting the shortest end of the stick on the control. So there you go.
Yeah, this is probably my new least favorite episode, so Larry, you're off the hook. I think my impression of this episode was that it was going to be more focused on Vic and Rita in the present and not so much on Niles. So the fact that there was so much on Niles and that it was so long and that it was so kind of drawn out kind of made the episode seem really long and not as interesting. like I mentioned earlier, and like Tati mentioned, the fact that he was like so affronted that she basically saved his ass, and he's like, "Oh, you're trying to kill me." Oh, you know, and then when she finds out that she's not trying to kill him, "Oh, you only want me as a pet? This is not how we do this. I'm a human being." When he wasn't even going to treat her like a human being in the first place, which is so privileged white dude to me. And the whole time that he was with her, like when he first got introduced to Wolf Deer God or whatever, I thought, oh my God, this is going to be like Mononoke Hime, where he kills the deer god because he thinks that it will, you know, or he thought he was, at some point, he was going to play her, and it would be in battle for her that she would die, that the wolf deer god would die, that he would destroy this, you know, world that he intruded upon in the first place. And so I just was not, like, looking forward to that. And so then when it, like, abruptly changed to this romantic thing, like, the buddy thing was kind of like, okay, you know, this is weird. Like, what is he, because he's still, like, taking notes and observing her like she's in the zoo, like him running around her trying to, like, draw a picture and all this kind of stuff. I was waiting for, like, the shoe to drop. And so when the shoe dropped and it was, and her clothes dropped as well, I was like, wait a minute. It was like a very, like, left-handed turn. And even after that, like, when the hunter guy finds Niles again and tells him about how they're the Bureau of Normalcy now and how they're going to, you know, basically kill her, I was still waiting for that shoe to drop and for him to betray her or whatever. So, I mean, I guess yay that he didn't, but I think I agree with you, Tati, that it's the fact that there was no, like, communication or no, he didn't, I don't know how much he actually, like, learned from her other than that one word. He learned two words. He learned one word that had to do with, like, the god, or I guess love, and the other word had to do with, like, the ice hole that he led the guy to.
Right.
But, like, there is no really kind of communication to show you how much their relationship had developed or gotten deeper. I didn't really understand or believe until the end that he was actually, like, in love with her. So I thought that was weird. And then back on the present side with the deer beard hunter, the fact that it was, one, so little of, like, the actual plot of the whole episode with Vic and Rita. But he is so gross, this beard hunter. Like, I was eating when he went into the bathroom, and I'm almost, like, trying not to gag now, but it was just so disgusting. Yeah, that was unnecessary. Like, I can't even say it now, because I just did not need to see it. I did not need to see it. I don't need it replaying in my head. So that was just gross and unnecessary. The end. Oh, well, I guess, like, not the end, but Mr. Nobody kind of butting into the end of Niles' wet dream sequence with Slava. I don't really know what Mr. Nobody's purpose or his endgame is anymore. It seemed like it was just random. I want to torture Niles, but now there's a specific reason, and why does he want to go after Slava? Like, I don't understand. And I didn't really think it was explained or hinted at very well.
I thought they were going to get more answers because this episode was so Niles heavy. Like, in terms of how they introduced the whole she's lived for so long thing and how that would come into play, but they didn't. And I thought it was very, because I mentioned it was, like, very reminiscent of pre-World War I era where the explorers would go off to find things and kind of, I just recall, like, World War Z where the guy went to find this lost city in the Amazon and came across, and he was never found again, but like how he kind of mistreated the natives there. And this kind of felt like that in a way because it was very, it was a little bit white savior-ish. And especially considering, like you guys said already, you know, how he disrespected her, considering the fact that she's been around for many, many years, so I felt like it was weird that he was coming in and trying to protect her, and then they just didn't seem like they learned anything from, like, he didn't learn much from her, and we didn't see what she learned from him or, like, the history of her, because she didn't really get to speak at all. Or the glimpses, like, on the tree of the carvings, we didn't really get a chance to really delve into that, and that was really frustrating. So when I had envisioned what Niall's story would be, this was not it. This weird love story that didn't need to necessarily happen, I think is really bizarre, and it was a little, I was a little bit weirded out by it, to be honest. I agree about Mr. Nobody, like, losing, we're losing track of what his point is, like, what does he want her for now that she's been introduced? Is it just that she has, she can keep people alive for a long time, and if so, like, how did he end up passing it along to the Doom Patrol, and I don't know, it was just, like, a weird intro into, like, his backstory, I think, that could have been different. And then with Vic, I completely agree that he is the least developed of all the Doom Patrol team members, and they keep giving him moments where he can explore that, but he never really gets to, and that's getting really frustrating. So hopefully next episode will be better, because I wasn't feeling this one either. Do we have any predictions for the future of this show?
I guess that Slava is going to become, or the Dear Wolf God thing is going to become more of a driving force in whatever this season is meant to take us to.
I think that, speaking of Slava, we're going to see how he turned that into making the Jupiter immortal, because I'm still on this.
Yeah.
Yeah, because for me, like, I forgot to mention, it seems manipulative because he is kind of using her stuff for other purposes while she's off being hidden, and it's great that he's, like, protecting her and everything, but it's just, I don't know. Anyway. I don't have any predictions. So, side B, lady with...
Oh, I also thought it was really, like, another point to the Niles is an asshole column, but the fact that when Mr. Nobody was pushing him on it, and he says, I don't care what you do to Doom Patrol, so he's, like, just built, he's taking her culture, making these random people that probably didn't ask to be immortal, immortal, and doesn't even care about them as people, but they're trying to find him because they think that he's this great guy. Mm-hmm. So, whatever. Sad times.
Lady with Gumption, side B, nominee. Who are we picking from Flash and Doom Patrol?
I mean, I do think that Nora is probably the Lady with Gumption. For Flash, she did have to figure out, you know, what to do with her powers on her own and decide who to trust. And she did take a big leap of faith in trusting Abarth, even if we don't agree with that leap of faith.
And she's kind of a spaz. Like, as soon as she figured out she got speedster powers, like, she immediately wanted to help. And she was a little bit spazzy, like, trying to help in the first, like, her first superhero outing didn't go well. But I think that she definitely, from the time that she figured out that she could do something, she had a lot of gumption into wanting to help people.
Right.
Wanting to go after Godspeed, things like that. And I guess finally Iris, and present Iris, 2019 Iris, for believing in her daughter enough to give her a second chance to explain herself.
Yes. And then from Doom Patrol, Slava?
Slava sounds like a good choice.
Yeah. All right, so we have side A. We've got Zari and Felicity, and side B, we have Nora with a backup assistant, Iris, and Slava. So, who are we narrowing it down to?
I definitely...
Felicity.
Yeah, that was about the same thing. I think Felicity wins.
Yep. No discussion necessary. Felicity.
Oh, Felicity, okay, wins the whole thing? All right.
Yeah.
Do you want to voice your dissent, May?
Well, I was going to say, not in that Nora's, I was just going to debate, because I thought that's what was happening, but Nora's like, okay, Felicity.
This is not a democracy.
And also, I feel bad, because I think this is the first time that Nora's been nominated at all, so.
Okay. That can't be true.
I think it is.
I'm pretty sure we nominated her early on in this season.
I don't recall her being nominated at all. I don't know why. Because I can't go back and think of, like, any specific moments where she would have been nominated, I guess.
Well, what's your, other than she hasn't been before, what's your argument that she should be, that she should win?
I guess just because it was an information overload for her, and I think she tried to handle it the best way that she could, and she was active in trying to find out the truth and, you know, getting shit done, even though it was certain things that we didn't, you know, like, but she still did them. She was active in her own plot.
Okay. Okay, okay. She is a solid silver medal.
Okay. All right. Felicity for episode 80, Lady with Gumption winner. Again, we are the Ladies with Gumption. You can always find us on Twitter when we are live tweeting our asses off on Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday nights. And that's DCTV Gumption. You can send all your lovely thoughts to ladieswgumption@gmail.com or an ask through Tumblr, ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. And we will be back next week with all five shows, Supergirl included.
I'm gonna die.
Yes. So, last minute note taking. But we will see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.